May it please the court, my name is Carl Fletcher and I'm appearing here today on behalf of the appellant here, Trafalgar House Construction, Inc. We're asking the court to reverse a May 2nd, 2007 judgment of the Court of Federal Claims, denying all of Trafalgar House's claims and awarding the government $1 million in principal on its counterclaim. And we're asking the judgment in the amount of $6.4 million be entered instead in favor of Trafalgar House. This case had its genesis in the Department of Labor's decision to relocate a Job Corps center that was in downtown Charleston, West Virginia, to a more campus-like setting that ended up being on a mountaintop area just outside the city limits of Charleston. The design for the project, it was like a small college campus. It had dormitories and other buildings, and I think 11 buildings initially. When they went out and actually leveled the top of the mountain, they found that they could not fit all the buildings onto the site. So rather
but,
than
but on the legal side,
yes.
Do you agree that it's up to you that the building to show that a reasonable contractor would have an indication in the contract that,
special
lockdown? Yes. Do you agree that's the standard?
It is the standard.
What do you point to, what is in the record that your witnesses or you pointed to in the contract that creates this, that satisfies this indication? The contract has, and we cited in our brief,
a number of places where it says, well, first, it has in a seismic report, a seismic study that was done as part of the geotechnical reports that were included, expressly included in the contract documents. It had a contour and elevation of the bedrock throughout the site. So it said, here is not just some core borings, there were core borings, but this is also a seismic study done that said, essentially, here is the elevation in the plane of the competent bedrock on the project. It also had, in the geotechnical reports, a very specific, and I mean very detailed, down to the percentage amount, of the amount of competent bedrock that would be found at those elevations and how much of that would be usable for this special rock fill, or SRF as it was termed from time to time. It also had in the geotechnical reports, and it's only in the geotechnical reports, these side hill fills that were necessary to give this hilltop enough room to put these all these buildings and construct this campus. It had in those side hill fills, and there were seven of them for the entire site, a 15-acre site, it said, here are the elevations that the bedrock is going to be found. So you had something that said,
so here. Don't you have a problem? I mean, if you're looking at the contract, you can't point to anything in the contract other than the geotechnical report, and that seems to be the answer. Wasn't there a disclaimer in that report that says you can't rely on anything in this report to establish what the cost of construction will be?
Well, yes, there was a limitation of liability provision with the geotechnical reports. Now, I would say again that the geotechnical reports, unlike most construction contracts, certainly most government, they were expressly incorporated into the contract. So they are a part of the contract. They are not, this is not something that's advisory. They were incorporated into the contract by express incorporation. And the side hill fills, which are the essence of this whole issue about the differing site condition and the special rock fill that was used to construct it, that was the only place in the plans and specifications where any sort of description or drawing or anything that described those, either graphically or verbally, was included. So they had to be incorporated in the contract documents. That limitation of liability provision, and the trial court placed some, I think, undue emphasis on that, was essentially a the content and purpose of that had nothing to do with the limitation of liability as it relates to and bears on the different site conditions claim. That was a disclaimer that said from the sub-consultant who prepared the geotechnical study to the project design professional, look, I'm giving this to you, but it's for a limited purpose. We had expert testimony at trial that said that from a person who prepares such types of reports, it said That has never been used. The intent of that provision is never to limit the owner's liability on a different site conditions claim. We also, the language of the provision itself does not preclude recovery under the different site conditions claim. In fact, the limitation of liability provision, and it's in the volume one of the joint appendix at 1370, said it is prepared primarily to aid in the design of site work and structural foundations. That's exactly what was being done here. This involves exactly that, site work. The bulk of this claim relates to site work and structural foundations. And it says the information in the report is expected to be sufficient for these purposes. It goes on to say it is not intended to determine the cost of construction or standalone as a construction specification. But it's saying, here is this information. It's designed for exactly the reason for which the contractor here, Trafalgar House, and its subcontractor used it. And it's expected to be sufficient for those purposes. It does also mention that there's going to be variations in the soils from, it says soil variations may exist between borings, and these variations may not become evident until construction. This claim has nothing to do with soils. The contract documents define soil as something totally different than rock, which is self-evident, but I mean, they actually had definitions of each of those materials. It had a definition of soils, it had a definition of rock, and it had a definition of the material that was suitable for use in special rock fill. So this limitation of liability provision doesn't really address at all or preclude usage of the references related to the bedrock and the competency of rock for purposes of construction or for use as a basis for contract indications sufficient to justify a finding that there was a type 1 different site condition. The contractors here had no choice. They were given these reports, said these are part of the construction documents, and they had to be used as construction documents because there was nowhere else, literally nowhere else, in the three volumes of plans and specifications for the project where the side hill fills, which were the essential part of the construction, the buildings are literally founded on this these side hill fills. There was no other place to find to go to describe that describe how to construct it. So that, yes, there are ample indications. What, when you read all those reports and you read the documents, the concern, and this is the irony of this case in the ruling of the court below, the concern was not that there would not be enough special rock fill or competent bedrock material. It was exactly the opposite. They were so concerned that the rock here, and you'll see reference after reference to bedrock very shallow, they were concerned that they were not even going to be able, without blasting and special techniques, to get the water lines, electrical lines, other utility lines in without blasting. That was the concern that they had.
Well,
not
just an aside up here, I mean, who determined the site?
Department of Labor. They picked the site. Yeah, and they could have done a lot of different things, but that's neither here nor there. They could have just cut the site down and they had a bigger site.
Before your time runs out, let me ask you about the sort of side issue, particularly, I'm sure, from your point of view, which is if we agree with the trial court that you can't meet the total cost methodology, then I need to agree with your left with this argument about whether or not you're entitled to at least a portion of $1 million that you got from the
by and large, that's true. I mean, we used the total cost, modified total cost methodology for the bulk of the claim, and we think it's perfectly justified. But yeah,
why was the district court? But you take issue with the court of claims judge, who then determines you're not entitled to that. You presented one methodology for determining damages.
Yes.
The total cost. You lost on that. Assuming we agree with her that she was correct, you should have lost. What claim can you possibly be left with to try to get back that $400,000 or $500,000 out of the million?
The trial court, the government put on two witnesses, the John Steenbergen, the contracting officer, and they had a consultant, a gentleman by the name of John McTyre. Both testified that, in essence, that Trafalgar House was entitled to approximately $500,000. There was some variation between the two. Steenberger testified that Trafalgar House was entitled to recover $466,000.
Yeah, but you never asked, did you? I mean, you didn't say we want total costs, but in the alternative, if he moves on that, we think there's a sufficient damage calculation that's been done for purposes of the record for us to at least retain that portion to which the government's witnesses put evidence. I mean, you never...
Well, obviously, at the trial, we're going to go for the appropriate amount of damages that we thought, and we thought that that was nowhere near justified.
No, I understand.
In your theory that the total cost methodology was the appropriate methodology would have been significantly undercut had we pled an alternate claim for, you know, We can't itemize, therefore total cost methodology is appropriate, but alternatively, if you don't believe us on that, we are itemizing and submitting.
Yeah, here's that's one of those alternative situations that you just can't have. It's sort of mutually exclusive.
But you're trying to have it not. I mean, but I understand that tactical decisions lawyers must make, but that's exactly what you're arguing to us now.
Now, what I'm arguing to you now is that there was no evidence that the court below was faced with a situation where the government itself, tantamount to an admission, says, we have determined that you can use unit cost, and we did an analysis, and we prepared a report specifically, and we are presenting to this court on our counterclaim, which is their burden that to bear on that, that Trafalgar House is entitled to approximately $500,000 back. So what our position in the brief, we're not inconsistent. We're saying we believe the modified total cost methodology is appropriate. The government then puts on a counterclaim, and the evidence that they adduce at trial to support their counterclaim, two witnesses, both of whom says, we conclude and we testify that...
No, is that the way it went down? Because that wasn't the testimony. The government was using, I thought, when they amended it, to try to get back that money. What they said is based on the judge's decision that, you know, you're not entitled to any damages because you didn't prove any up under the total cost, that they're entitled to that. I didn't think they were, for purposes of getting the 400, the 600 back or whatever, they were saying rely on their evidence.
Well, they actually put the two witnesses on it.
So that was before, yes, at trial.
Yeah, that was when they were claiming a partial recovery. And then subsequently, the counterclaim was amended, and they said, well, in light of the failure of the total cost methodology, we're amending our claim because we're entitled to full recovery.
At the trial, they actually took their pleadings initially was they were entitled to the entirety of $1 million back. And then they put on the two witnesses that said $500,000 roughly, the variation between it, but yes. That's exactly what they did. They always, the amendment.
Okay, so what was your answer to that during the trial? Did you put on anyone to say, no, they're not entitled to any of it back? Other than your general claim that dealt with the total cost methodology?
No. What we had, the evidence of trial at that point was that we just confirmed that was their testimony. And, you know, I think our strategy at that point was, at the very least, they shouldn't get any money back. I mean, their testimony and evidence, we were willing to accept the testimony that if we lost everything, that at least on their counterclaim, we would at least keep $500,000 roughly. But we didn't try to counter that in any way at the trial. We didn't put on any rebuttal or surrebuttal type testimony to their counterclaim that said, well, it should be something different.
Was there any question that the $1 million was a loan or an advance and not a payment?
It was an advance on what would proceed to be legitimate claims. I mean, there's no real documentation, as I recall. There's nothing that says this is a change order or anything. It's not payment on the underlying project.
On
Yes, it was definitely for the claims.
All right, we've used up all of your time. We'll restore 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Chandler.
May it please the court. Trafalgar House failed before the Court of Federal Claims to prove its different site condition claim, to prove its delay claim, and prove its damages.
Do you agree that the geotechnical report was part of the contract?
Yes, we don't disagree with that point.
So why would, I mean, do you disagree with his view of the other side's view of the substance of what that said, or just the import of that with respect to the indication issue?
I think both really. I think what Trafalgar has done is they've mischaracterized what it says, and they've also asked the court to take the view that you can look at the language in the contract and that Trafalgar was entitled to extrapolate its own conclusions from that language, and neither of those is correct. Under Weeks, the court said that you have to look at, quote, reasonably plain, concise, unambiguous, and unequivocal language, and there clearly is no unambiguous or unequivocal representation as to the subsurface contents of this project site.
But they did have testimony that an expert or whatever that said that this is the way some reasonable contractor construed this line, right?
That's right. And so really,
did have any testimony that was not, was there other testimony that it was at best ambiguous, that it was not being properly construed by their expert?
Well, there was testimony that it simply wasn't an indication of what the subsurface contents were.
Because?
And I can walk you through that, actually. It would be probably most helpful to look at the particular documents. If you look at the administrative record at page 1369, this is the portion of the geotechnical report that is cited most frequently by Trafalgar.
Uh-huh.
And the language that they're relying on is under the heading Task 5, Additional Rock Core Nature of Bedrock at Core Locations. This is the 76% language that they continuously rely on.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it reads is, the combined results for a supplemental and original rock
core. No, I can read it.
Okay.
So your read of this language is?
Well, there are really 3 points here. First, this language relates to the composition at bedrock in each of these borings, not before you get to bedrock. And if you look in the administrative record at,
also, this doesn't reflect quantity of material. It may reflect characteristics, but not necessarily quantities.
Well, what your founder is saying is that this amounts to a representation that 76% of the project site, I think is what they would like the court to believe, is composed of material that is suitable for special rock fill. But that's simply not the case. What this says is that programs indicate that competent bedrock at core locations. Those are the two key points. First, we're talking about competent bedrock. And if you look at page 1433 in the administrative record, you can see, and in subsequent pages, you can see the actual boring data. And I think 1433 is a particularly good example of this. If you look at each of those rectangles, those sort of downward pointing rectangles, is a boring. And if you look on each of those, there is a line that is below which is a series of X's. That's the bedrock. So what this statement is saying is that 76% of what's below the bedrock is suitable for special rock fill. But if you look up, there's a longer dotted line below the number 1145, and it's labeled finished floor elevation. See that? It's, the number is 1143.5. That's actually the level at which the plans called for excavation down to. So in other words, the excavation is only going to go to the finished floor. And it's clear from these diagrams that they weren't actually going to excavate down to the bedrock, which is what this representation relates to. So that's the first point, that there is no representation about anything other than the bedrock. Secondly, this representation relates only to the core locations. There's no indication of what the conditions are like in between the core locations. And in that way, this case is very similar to Weeks. Thirdly, there's no representation that whatever amount is down there is going to be sufficient for the purposes of meeting special rock fill requirements at this project site. It simply does not say that. It simply says what the percentage is of the bedrock at the core locations. So clearly, there is no reasonably plain, concise, unambiguous, and unequivocal language as is required by Weeks. Now, Trafalgar has argued as an alternative that the court should apply a reasonable contractor standard, or what a reasonable contractor would extrapolate from the language of the contract. But there is no requirement for a reasonable contractor standard in Weeks. The language relating to reasonableness of the contractor in Weeks is really saying that you have to look at how a reasonable contractor would understand the language. In other words, would a reasonable contractor find that there was a reasonably plain, concise, unambiguous, and unequivocal indication of what the conditions are? Not would a reasonable contractor take that information and draw all sorts of other conclusions from whatever statements there are in the contract. But nonetheless, that's what Trafalgar is asking the court to do. It's even more unreasonable under these circumstances because the contract contained or incorporated FAR provision 52.236-3, which reads, the government assumes no responsibility for any conclusions or interpretations made by the contractor based on information made available by the government. So the government is explicitly saying in the contract, we make no representations as to what conclusion, you know, the conclusions that you draw with respect to the data that we're giving you. I think Trafalgar's reading would also render the third prong of the different site condition claim redundant. The third prong relates to whether the contractor reasonably relied on the information that was provided. And so if you graft a reasonableness requirement onto the indication prong of that test, then there's no reason for to determine whether a reasonable whether the contractor reasonably relied in the third portion of that test. It would simply, in effect, read out the third prong of that test. But even if you apply a reasonable contractor standard, as Trafalgar had asked you to do, it simply wasn't reasonable for Trafalgar to draw the conclusions that it drew from the data that it was given. And in fact, the Court of Federal Claims specifically held that, quote, it was unreasonable for THC to extrapolate from H.C. Dunning's analysis of the rock core samples, i.e., because 76% of the bedrock at core locations may have been suitable for the use of special rock fill, 76% of the bedrock over the entire site was also usable as special rock fill. So the Court of Federal Claims drew a conclusion on that point. And that determination is a question of fact and therefore subject to clear error review, which Trafalgar has not shown clear error.
Before you run out of time, let me ask you about that sub-issue.
Yes.
The government concedes, does it not, that Trafalgar suffered some damages that were a result of these different subconditions?
No. What our experts, or what the expert and the contracting officer testified with respect to, is their testimony related to whether or not it was possible to do a unit cost analysis. And in that context, they referred to the calculations they had done in the context of Trafalgar's request for equitable adjustment. But in doing those calculations, they relied on the information that was in Trafalgar's request for equitable adjustment.
But there's no question that the government concedes at least that there's some liability, not necessarily the amount of damages, but some, that there was a basis for an equitable adjustment of some sort.
That actually was not decided by the Court of Federal Claims, and I don't know that we're ready to concede that now. The Court of Federal Claims went directly to the damages issue, so
I thought it was uncontested.
And you put the contracting officer on, right?
That's right.
And the contracting officer had reached a certain conclusion, and that was that the bedrock was lower, blah, 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 worth $241,000, that DOL was liable for $4,900 for resulting delays, and blah, blah, blah. Isn't that... If that's the government witness and they're saying, isn't that a concession of liability with respect to those amounts?
No, because all that springs from the evidence in Trafalgar's request for equitable adjustment, and the same evidence was not put on at trial. In other words, Trafalgar itself had done a unit cost analysis, and based on that was in its request for equitable adjustment, and that's what the contracting officer and the government's expert used. They basically took the numbers that were in the REA and did their own calculations based on those numbers. But there wasn't proof in the record of at trial of the facts underlying their claims in the REA because they never went back to the unit cost analysis. So,
was the government putting this on to show that you could do a unit cost analysis so that the total cost was not the right measure of damages?
That's right.
Is that why these guys were on?
That's right. That's right.
But I guess it is a little troubling, the sequence of events, it seems to me, because the government didn't request this money back until after the trial concluded.
That's right.
And what happened? They said, whoops. The judge said, no, total cost was out. Maybe we have another theory here. We get back this $100,000 that we thought was otherwise owed. Right? Yeah. I mean, what led the government to file its amended claim in the case?
I believe it was on that basis. I can't say for certain exactly what the sequence of events was, but that is my understanding. That
it but don't you think the applying some sort of fairness standard that they came to trial and they, particularly given your witnesses, I mean, they could have reasonably thought, could they not, that the government had already conceded liability up to at least $500,000 or whatever, so they didn't have to put on a case with respect to that amount. In the alternative.
Well, certainly that's something they could have established through discovery, or they could have established through a stipulation prior to trial. And there's no evidence that is the case. I mean,
but you're saying they could have discovered through discovery. I mean, there was a record in the case, and the only record with respect to liability or damages with respect to this discrete issue was the uncontroverted testimony of the government, which is, this is what we owe you for this month.
Assuming that your numbers are correct. The REA numbers.
Isn't this a burden of proof question? You filed a counterclaim for the lesser amount, the full amount. And don't you have a burden of proof to show that you're entitled to that money back?
No, really.
And, as I understand what you're saying, you really presented no proof in your counterclaim.
Well, really, Trafalgar has the burden of proof on the issue of damages.
The counterclaim?
Well, on the issue of damages, really, the counterclaim, we would have had...
You're trying to get your money back.
That's right, and the government had the burden of proof to show that the nature of the $1 million payment was, in fact, an advance on any amounts owed under the request for equitable adjustment.
Sure.
But there was no dispute as to that. That fact is never questioned.
Do you think that's all you had to show?
I believe that's all the burden. The only burden on the government is to show that. After, because the issue of the amount of damages owed to Trafalgar was a separate issue. For
yeah, the failure to prove that Trafalgar may have had on its case doesn't necessarily make your case. You have a burden of proof of your own.
Well, in this case.
On your case.
In this case, it necessarily does. I mean, our counterclaim was strictly, in effect, an accounting issue. There's no issue apart from.
It's still a counterclaim and a burden of proof question.
Pardon?
It's still a counterclaim and then you had the burden of proof.
That's right. We had the burden of proof to show that we were entitled to a return of some money after Trafalgar failed to meet its burden of proof to prove damages.
And did you? That's my question.
Again, that issue.
Did you really say that it was no proof on the counterclaim?
Well, the issue is as to the nature of the payment.
You say the $500,000 was not proof. All you have that the court found, the founder didn't carry its burden on damage.
That it didn't offer any.
If it didn't carry its burden, then you don't have a burden on the counterclaim.
That's right. And there are really two issues that relates to the counterclaim. First is the issue of whether Trafalgar is entitled to any damages. And then the second issue is whether the $1 million payment to Trafalgar was in the nature of an advance or if it was some other type of payment. The issue of whether Trafalgar is entitled to any damages is an issue in which they have the burden of proof. But the issue as to whether the payment was a $1 million advance is something the government would have burden of proof with respect to under its counterclaim.
You say your only burden on the counterclaim is just prove this an advance and not a payment.
That's right.
Because you're saying that they weren't otherwise, this money was just up for grabs because it was an advance, so it was part of their overall burden and they wanted anything to show it.
Well, that's right. And if they wanted to keep the money under the advance, they had to prove their damages at trial. And their failure to do that meant that they weren't entitled to any damages. Now, that having been established, in order for the government to reclaim that $1 million, it simply had to show that $1 million was in advance against any amounts that were eventually owed as a result of the request for equitable adjustment or the lawsuit.
Did they use the admissions of the CEO and the expert as their proof? Damages?
Well, certainly they can't use the contract.
You had a burden of going forward. Yeah, you did. You said, by showing it was in advance. And then they have a proof there of showing damages, and they have an admission.
But again, that admission was based on evidence that wasn't in. I mean, in fact, what the contracting officer and the government's expert were asked to do at trial is to provide a calculation, assuming that Trafalgar's numbers submitted as part of the request for equitable adjustment were correct.
Well, in a normal setting where you don't have any total cost methodology claim, you have one party comes in and says the other party owes me $7 million, and then the other side says, well, no, it's not seven, it's no more than $500,000. But usually the resolution then is somewhere between those two, and if the party doesn't prove seven, at least they're entitled to get to $500,000, not to go back to zero.
But I don't think that's true, actually. I think if the other party comes into court and fails to prove any of its damages, then it's not entitled to anything. And certainly in the context of a settlement discussion.
But where there's a sort of a concession that there's the damages may not be seven, they're no more than $500,000. That concession usually establishes the floor, and a resolution would be something between those two limits. Here, there seems to be no dispute that there was some differing site condition that warranted some amounts of some sort, and the contracting officer came up with $500,000. Now, the parties didn't agree on that number because the contractor claimed that it was greater than that, and the contractor then submits a total cost methodology claim and doesn't item. But nonetheless, the testimony is there that the contracting officer concedes there's a differing site condition and submits some basis to conclude that the amount of money involved is about $500,000. And why is it appropriate for the government to get a buy and come away with a full recovery?
Because really, and I see that my time has expired, so
that's my short answer.
Because really, the nature of the contracting officer's testimony at trial and the government's expert's testimony at trial sprung from the assumption that Trafalgar was able to prove its unit cost damages. In other words, its unit cost assertion in its request for equitable adjustment was assumed to have been correct for those purposes. But they failed to prove that at trial. So,
well, on their claim, they failed to prove it because they picked the wrong method of proving damages. That's all. But the fact remains that the $500,000 remains proved by itemizing.
But only if you assume that their claims in the request for equitable adjustment were accurate. In other words, the government didn't make any effort to verify those costs were actual costs.
You have a challenge, and it's your burden.
Well, no, that's their burden for their damages.
If you don't think their CEO and their expert are right, you should have challenged.
Again,
show them where they're wrong.
That's Trafalgar's burden, however, to show their damages.
You're trying to get money back.
Right, but I think in order to do that, we only need to show a much more limited. The burden in the first place is on Trafalgar to show that they're entitled to damages at all. That's right.
Not on your.
That's right.
All right.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's hear from Mr. Fletcher.
Thanks for the additional few minutes.
they did address, and they take up several issues, the, at trial, they did have an expert that talked about the reasonableness of the contract indications. But he used, this was Mr. McTighe, and he used the same sort of overly restrictive definition that the trial court used, which was in the absence of an express representation that no special rock field would be imported, or an express representation of the quantity to be found on site or to be used in the construction of the side of the fields, that there is no such thing as a contract indication. And that's the case law, including the Weeks dredging case, do not say that. They've never said that. It's never been the position of this court or the Court of Federal Claims. It's a reasonable interpretation, and it's, the case law says repeatedly it does not be, need to be expressed or explicit. And that imports, by the nature of that definition, that you're going to have to look at the, at what's there and perhaps have some interpretive background. It's the reasonableness of that interpretation that's at issue. You look at the Weeks dredging case, which the trial court relied on fairly heavily, and the government definitely relied on heavily in their briefing. And that case is really legally and factually inapposite. In that case, the, it was a dredging, river dredging case, or body of water dredging, I believe it was a river. Most of the core locations were outside the work zone, and the contractor extrapolated, made the assumption that the court said was unwarranted, that the conditions in one borehole were the same halfway to the next borehole. Here, the big distinction is, and the counsel ignored in their argument and in their briefing, is that not only did we have these coring locations that said, here's the composition of materials. And there was no evidence offered at trial that, that was inaccurate. In fact, the testimony was that those were accurate. The 76% representations were accurate. What, well, they were accurate as to the composition of the of materials, sandstone and siltstone. The, we had that bedrock, the seismic study that says, we didn't have to extrapolate from one core hole to the other. We had a seismic study that says, here is the way the competent bedrock reads underneath the site. So we had a prediction of, here's what, if you didn't have to extrapolate from hole to hole, it said, here's where the competent bedrock level, that's what a seismic study does. So we didn't have the issue they had there. Also, all the coring locations on, in this case, were within the work zone of the site. In Weeks, all but 13 of the 156 taken were outside of the work area. So the courts there said, yeah, look, you had, you made unreasonable assumptions. You extrapolated from core hole to core hole, but there's no basis for doing that. And most of them were outside the work zone. Not totally unlike what's here. The citation to the appendix with respect to the core locations and the finished floor elevations, the council said, well, we weren't even going to get down to that. Well, the finished floor elevation is not the elevation of excavation. That's the elevation of the finished floor. You excavate significantly below that, so you would be getting into the bedrock. And that he picked out one particularly egregious example. There were many of them that, that showed that you were going to be in the bedrock area, and you were going to be doing that. And there was no indication, and that government put on no evidence at trial, that, that the reason that there was the contractor did not find enough special rock material had anything at all to do with their misreading of the cores, whether in terms of where the bedrock would be located, or that they misinterpreted what the coring log represented. And in fact, remember the side hill fill excavations, the drawings that have, show those actually have the elevations where they tie into those elevations. Now, with respect to the government's counterclaim, and significant amount of time on that, the evidence that was offered at trial had nothing to do with, well, we're looking at what the REA said and based on those assumptions. McTighe, their expert, had prepared a report 1 month and before trial, August of 2005, the trial was in the first week of September 2005. And he said in there, I'm looking at a fresh look. It wasn't, well, do we justify the request for equitable adjustment? He's doing it as any expert would do. What is the government, what is the contractor entitled to on its counterclaim? Or what is the contractor entitled to on the two of the three claims that we found liability for? And one of the facts that's been overlooked here is that there were three separate types of different site They're all different type 1, different type 1, different thing, but three separate claims. The government conceded liability on two of the three, so they were putting a damage figure on two of those three claims. It said, we come up with $500-some thousand is due. That's an, even a different number that was in the REA, so it wasn't anything to do with that.
All right, thank you. Your time has expired, and I thank both counsel.